Well, this evening I want to talk about blowing trumpets, or that which is related to it. And as we get started, I want to kind of get an introduction going on Jeremiah chapter 1 to remind us where we're headed. Verse 9. Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 9, it says, "Then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth." That would be Jeremiah's mouth. "And the Lord said unto me, Behold, I have put my words in thy mouth. See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out, to pull down, to destroy, and to throw down, and to build, and to plant." And we have in this portion of Scripture a discussion which is related to the idea that Jeremiah was to be a person who spoke forth to those people who were in his nation and to reach them because they had gotten in trouble with the Lord. And so we've gone through several chapters, and I'd like to go forward now to chapter 6 of Jeremiah. And when we're talking about the idea of Jeremiah to speak forth like this to the nations and those who were out there, we spent time in that first chapter talking about the fact that Jeremiah isn't the only one who is to, I'll say it this tonight, blow his trumpet, the trumpet that would be there. In chapter 6, verse 1, it says, "O ye children of Benjamin, gather yourselves to flee out of the midst of Jerusalem and blow the trumpet in Tekoa and set up a sign of fire in Beth..." I can't say that. "For evil appeareth out of the north and great destruction." That word I couldn't say has to do with the idea that it's a house. Beth would be house. And that other rest of it talks about a vineyard is the word for vineyard. And so pastor's been talking about wine this morning. That's this is a place where they made it. And so it's apparently is a location which would be related to the children of Benjamin, and it is to be a warning. Now, trumpets have always been, or largely been, at least in Israel, the idea of a signal. A signal that, well, just kind of like the military. You start with a trumpet in the morning over the loudspeaker system. In the old days when they didn't have that, so they just blew it across the camp. And wake up, guys. They also blew one to go to bed. They blew one to assemble. They blew one for various different reasons in the military camp. And so it was a signal, basically, to other people. And in this case, the trumpet, according to Hebrew, is a shofar. And so it's likely a curved instrument of some kind. And if you were to see pictures of a ram's horn or something of that nature that would be used, it is a warning sign of that which is to come. And I suppose if we were to go to the New Testament, that there is a trumpet sound that you and I should be listening for. That's when the Lord will be calling us forth to be gathered together with him before the time of great tribulation. And so this is a trumpet that is of considerable importance. And the reason that this trumpet is sounded is because there is considerable danger. It says in that last phrase of that first verse, "For evil appeareth." It's that which is going to be kind of like the idea that somewhere up north, there are some people... I don't know if you can understand this or not. You folks have windows, and you have glass in your windows, and you have casements that close this glass off. And even if you open them in the summertime, you've got something behind the glass we call a screen to keep all the bugs out. There's not too much probability that they had all that in those days when Jeremiah was around. And the probability is that they didn't have screens and very few places if they did have figured out how to do it. And so when things were going on, if you were going to anticipate something, like they would in Germany. We remembered some people that were over there when some of the ladies, they'd get up in the morning, they'd do their work, and then they'd sit at the window and kind of lean out, looking around to see what's coming off, what might be happening around the neighborhood, what could be happening. In this case, the window, or the idea here is that they would lean out of the window, and they would look to see what is the possibility for today on my schedule. In Germany, if the lady was leaning out the window and the neighbor was out there and she decided she was going to go out there with a bucket of water and scrub the porch off the steps and maybe the sidewalk in front. And I don't think too many did the street offhand, but they didn't. It wasn't uncommon they do that. Well, I suppose the other ladies would say, well, looks like if she's going to do it, she can't show me up. So I get my bucket of water and go down there and start doing the same thing. And those kind of things would be looking in anticipation, what is possibly on my day's schedule that I would have to think about? Well, when it talks about evil appeareth out of the north, it's the idea that the people from the north would be looking out their window, considering, you know, way off in the distance, we have Israel, and we have Jerusalem, way off in the north. Why, they've got this temple there with all the riches, and I think the idea is that God put in their mind to lean out their windows and to contemplate, and this would be everybody, especially the men in this case, contemplate, let's go and see if we can't kind of knock them down a notch or two. Remember now, Solomon wasn't too far before this, and he was the one who was the richest and most wise man in the region for a period of time. And his father David conquered almost everybody, including these people that probably would be coming out of the north. At least he put them on their heels. And so the idea is that, Israel isn't so strong anymore, but they seem to have all of these blessings that are there. Let's consider and lean out our window and think about what we might do and what Jerusalem might be as an advantage to us. And so it doesn't sound so much different than what we have today. We have different peoples who lean out the window and consider, what can I do to the nation next to me? Just as we would consider, what would we do to the neighbor next to me? And so here we have this opening here, O children of Benjamin. Now, remember, the children of Benjamin basically didn't have Jerusalem as their place of normal residence. The Benjamin was a tribe of Israel that was south of Judah, and Judah was the region, we could say county in this sense. Judah was the county which had their capital and the capital of the nation in it. And then the people from Benjamin would flow forth to Jerusalem, perhaps for trade, particularly for worship 3 times a year. And they would even spend a week or so on different occasions there in worship of the Lord. And so they would be, people of Benjamin would be flowing to Jerusalem off and on for various reasons. And so here we find that Jerusalem is the one who's the focus of the concern, especially when evil appeareth out of the north and great destruction. The people from Benjamin are kind of warned, you know, get out of there, you guys, go home. This is a dangerous place. This is a serious thing that's about to take place. And so when we're talking about blow the trumpet in Tekoa set up a sign of fire, the signal fire, you understand what a signal fire, well, maybe you don't. We don't use that anymore. We don't even use the telegraph anymore, do we? We use the TV set, the radio, and all those highfalutin people turn their computer on and read the news and say, okay, this is coming our way. We better be warned about it or be concerned. You're highfalutin. Almost everybody has a computer too. Well, okay, I'm sorry about that. So here we have the signal fire. You know, if we were to put a big signal fire up there at on top of the mountain there where the Myers live, and then move one across a couple hillsides along the way and put up another signal fire, maybe you'd think, well, that's a long time just to get a warning all the way to Katanning across these hilltops because something's going on. After all, you have to gather the wood and light the fire and blow on it and get it burn up nice and big and get it nice and bright, and you have to wait till nighttime so somebody can see it. But remember, that was reasonably fast communication in those days. If something was really, really important, there was to be of considerable concern, they would build this big signal fire, put a lot of brush in a pile and let it burn up 5, 10, 15, 20 feet, and that would be a warning. Something serious is going on. I don't think it would probably take too long. I wouldn't suppose that it would be too hard, but for a signal fire to maybe if we were to start one here and we were to put it to various locations across the countryside, I mean, we might be able to warn Chicago, if not the first night, the second night after all of these things. And how fast can you ride a horse to Chicago? And so, or walk and do these kinds of things. So this is something that we have to keep in mind. Signal fires in those days was considered fast communication, even though it might take you from 5 to 10 minutes or 20 minutes to get one from one fire to get it started, to get the next one started, You could probably get it quite a long ways, the notice, down the road. So the trumpet would be local, and the signal fire would be that across the hilltops down to the next region or to the next location. So here we have this warning that's going out. And the Benjaminites were told, flee, get out of that city, because these folks are leaning out the window considering just what they might be able to collect there and to be able to enjoy if they gathered a small army together and went and started doing these kinds of things. So we go to verse 2. We're looking at Jerusalem when we're looking at this, and perhaps the people of Israel is related to those from the north who were really a dangerous people. I have likened the daughter of Zion to a comely and delicate woman. Something that's pleasing to the eye, something that people would like to be around. The shepherds with their flocks shall come unto her. They shall pitch their tents against her round about. They shall feed everyone in his place. So this is where people would tend to go for safety. And they hammer the nails there for their tents, pegs and their stakes, and the ropes going up to the canvas and over the top of some sticks or whatever, poles. And around the city, that would be a place to resort to if you thought there was danger coming. The daughter of Zion, Jerusalem is a place considered the best place to perhaps go to run to if danger was to come from the outside. And so there they would be inclined to do this. Maybe that's why the Benjaminites were there, because they foresaw maybe there were some dangers coming along the way and maybe they had gone there for some safety. Verse 4, prepare ye war against her. Arise. And this would be the people from the north we're talking about here that would be thought of in this sense. Prepare ye war against her, arise, and let us go up at noon. For the day goeth away, for the shadows of the evening are stretched out. Arise, and let us go by night, and let us destroy her palaces. For thus hath the Lord of hosts said, hewn ye down trees, and cast a mount against Jerusalem, this city. This is the city to be visited. She is holy oppression in the midst of her. Now, I'd like to ask you, whose idea was it that these people from the north would lean out the window and consider, I wonder what Jerusalem has for me? You see, this didn't come in their hearts and their minds by themselves. They were a people and to whom the Lord placed the thoughts and the idea, go and ravage this city. Now, some people have trouble with this idea that the Lord would bring difficulty and sorrow upon the likes of me. But why not? Why not if? Now notice the reasons that this is going to take place. That last phrase in verse 6. She is holy oppression in the midst of her. Now, you come to a city and you find that oppression is taking place among the people, upon the people, and there's a difficulty involved there. Would you consider that a city you'd like to move to? When oppression is the rule of the day. I don't think I would want to go to a city like that that has a reputation like this. I mean, after all, why wouldn't that oppression be applied to me just as much as so many other people that were in that city? So I would suggest that this is a listing of sin number one that's in Jerusalem. And would be a reason that the Lord of hosts hath said, hewn down trees and mount against Jerusalem, cast a mound against this Jerusalem. This is the city to be visited. This city was deserving of some difficulties because they had sin number one. They oppressed, there was holy oppression in the midst of her. Verse 7, we come to the next one. As a fountain casteth forth her waters. Have you been to a city park and seen fountains cast the water up in the air and the winds will catch it and even blow it out of the basin of the fountain? Sometimes you get caught in the middle of that and you get, on a hot day you're refreshed, but in the wintertime you wouldn't think it was so great. But now, if the fountains of water are compared to wickedness, so the water coming out of the fountain is compared to wickedness and it's jetting, beaming out this way and that way, as a fountain casteth out her water, so she, that would be Jerusalem, casteth out her wickedness. And so the fountains would cast forth waters, and in this case there probably isn't a basin, and so the land which is round about is being washed with wickedness. Is that the city you want to go to? I don't think you want to live there either. So sin number two. Wickedness is being cast out around those who are in Jerusalem and those who are maybe affected by Jerusalem round about. So wickedness is cast out. Here we come to the next one. Violence and spoil is heard in her. Well, highway robbers, thievery, violence, death, because people arguing and fighting all the time. Sounds like Pittsburgh almost, doesn't it? And spoil. People are being ravaged with this situation and that situation. Boy, it does sound like Pittsburgh, doesn't it? Violence and spoil. Some of those towns or, you know, the communities in and around the edge of Pittsburgh is heard in her. So now we've had these things are listed here. Before me continually is grief and wounds. Now, grief is kind of like if you were to, we had one of these kids here went on a 60-mile canoe trip, and dad too, I think, wasn't it? And so here they had the paddle in her hand, they were going like this. You know, 60 miles, you don't do that in one day, not easily. You have to be going downstream and really working at it to get that far in one day, I'm sure, and the water would have to be running pretty swift. 60 miles, and, you know, after the fourth or fifth hour, you're still going like this, and pretty soon you have wounds on your hands if you're not wearing gloves. Anybody, any group had wounds in their hands? Blisters and such? Yeah, okay. And of course, if you're kneeling in the canoe, you're probably getting some sore spots on your knees, and you keep doing this. Well, you're only 4 or 5 hours down the stream, and you got to keep on doing this, and I don't know that they pushed you. Maybe you guys floated most of the way, but so you're going on down the stream. You're still paddling and getting 4 or 5 blisters on each hand. And every time you move that paddle or move your hand on that, you're rubbing it. Okay? And so as you're rubbing it, you say, I'm in grief. That's the concept that's here. It's an open wound that continues to be rubbed and made worse and worse and worse. That's what we would think of as we would think of grief here. And so And the idea of wounds would be someone whacking you. Now, I don't think you guys were whacking each other with paddles too much. I mean, I wouldn't say it didn't happen occasionally, but if it happened to where it got to the place where soreness was taking place and someone keep whacking you, so we have the raw flesh being continually aggravated and then someone whacking you with a stick or over the head with something. And this is the idea, before me continually is grief and wounds. Anybody want to move to Jerusalem now with all of this? This is the kind of thing this is the story, this is the setup that's being stated concerning Jerusalem. So we come down to verse 8, and it says, "Be thou instructed, O Jerusalem, lest my soul depart from thee, lest I make thee desolate and a land not inhabited." Be instructed. We don't have this as a common thing in society today. You don't have school teachers with rods that smack a child. You don't have whippings taking place in the public place when people do things that are wrong. But this is the idea. The idea of being struck is chastened. And you do what that is necessary to cause an individual to decide a clean heart and a clean way is the best way to have it. And so when it's talking about be instructed, O Jerusalem, the concept is involved there that we would go back to verses 5, 6, and in there. There's a people who are coming to instruct Jerusalem. They are there to chasten them, to cleanse them, to get rid of all this nastiness that's in their hearts and their lives, and to let them think that this is going to be a better way of life. Now, there's a lot of people in our lifetime, and I think I can say for every one of us, in terms of nations who have had other people come in and to chasten them. Some for good reason, and some maybe we're not sure how we can figure it out. But if we go back a few years, we could go to Stalin, and when he took a whole section of southwest Russia, you know, where the Chernobyl nuclear plant went haywire, that part of the country was clearly chastened. And you wonder, was there maybe some reason for that, even that God would take Stalin and chasten a people like that? What kind of lifestyle were they involved in that those things were going on? China, in the Cultural Revolution, the people were chastened. Was it because they chose or because the government chose to live a lifestyle that God allowed this kind of implosion to take place and those people were severely chastened and things really were tough? You take the killing fields of Cambodia, and they literally emptied the cities and chastened. Those people were chastened. Of course, they were involved in idolatry in most of these places where we would be talking about. Did they maybe not deserve some of this? That the Lord was wanting to take and cleanse them of their ways that were wicked ways and cause them to reconsider. I don't know how much we can go into this, but we can take it right up to the present day. There's still countries under severe situations where are they learning their lesson? Are they not? They are being chastened and brought down to serious situations. I could say that maybe there are a good number of countries in the world today who deserve the chastening of God because they are not following the will of God, the laws of God, nor are they willing to even listen to the things that he would have to say to them. Verse 9, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, they shall thoroughly glean the remnant of Israel as a vine. Turn back thine hand as a grape gatherer into the baskets." Now, we have the idea of chastening involved here. Verse 9 begins the open discussion of judgment that is involved there. And remember, when we're talking with the people who are not following, interested in listening to the will of God, they deserve chastening. They deserve chastening. Every single nation, every single people who do not listen to the will of God, the teaching of God, and follow in His instruction, they deserve chastening. There's no exception, as long as they're in a rebellious state. And so we're talking about chastening here. We're talking about they shall be gleaned, and this is Israel. This would be Jerusalem in particular. They shall thoroughly glean the remnant of Israel as a vine. Turn back thine hand as a grape gatherer into the baskets. One of the things that Israel was known for is that you didn't glean your fields. You didn't glean your vines. You went through and you picked and took the things that were easily gathered and put them in your baskets. You carried them to the storehouse. You sold them at the market, whatever it was. But the gleaning of the vines wasn't done, because the widow, the fatherless, and perhaps the stranger and various people would be then allowed, after you've gone through and gathered out of your fields, to go in and to gather what was left in those fields for their sustenance and their help and their needs, the needs that would be there, because they didn't have the blessing that was there, and this was God's way of blessing the stranger and such people who had needs. But here, we're finding that when the people from the north came, and they were to bring chastening into Jerusalem, Jerusalem wasn't to be left as a partially harvested field. Jerusalem was to be taken as a field which they went through and picked every single grape off of every vine and totally strip that field. And Jerusalem was to be stripped. That's the idea that's being implied here. And so, verse 10, when to whom shall I speak and give warning that they may hear? Now remember, we're referring back in verse 10. We're going back to the trumpet in verse 1. The trumpet call is out there. Listen. And now we're in verse 10, and God is speaking to Jerusalem itself and perhaps to the Benjaminites who should be leaving. To whom shall I speak and give warning that they may hear? And when it's the idea of giving warning, it's a message that's given and repeated and repeated and repeated. That's the implication that's involved there in that particular verse and that particular word, warning. Behold, their ear is uncircumcised. They cannot hearken. Behold, the word of the Lord is unto him a reproach. They have no delight in it. I've seen this situation already. You go out and just pigeonhole somebody on the street. Go to Walmart. Go to the mills. Go to some of the various stores in Butler. Go over to Indiana and just pigeonhole somebody and say, let me share with you the word of the Lord. Get out of my life. I don't have time for you. You're a bother. I don't want to listen to you. The word of the Lord is unto them a reproach. It's not considered a blessing at all should you try to do that. They have no delight in it. Now, how many people in our country are in that condition? Think about this now. How many people can you go up to just cold turkey and start talking about the word of the Lord? It's unto them a reproach. They have no delight in it. Folks, these people are people that is talked about here as their ear is uncircumcised. It's not given over in surrender and in giving to the things of the Lord. And the idea is they cannot hearken. They won't listen because their ear is not given to that which is righteousness. It's given to that which is wickedness. They cannot hearken. Just as a curiosity, Abraham was to circumcise his sons and that they were to be given to the Lord. Then we have another place where it talks about they have an uncircumcised heart. They aren't willing to reason and listen to the things that are there. They have no desire for the things of the Lord. Now we have the uncircumcised ear in this passage. I hadn't thought about that before this, and I began to realize this idea of uncircumcised is that they're not prepared to even have an inclination towards these things. Therefore, in verse 11, I am full of the fury of the Lord. I suppose this might be thought of from Jeremiah's point of view, possibly. I am full of the fury of the Lord. I am weary with holding in. I will pour it out upon the children abroad and upon the assembly of the young men together. Even the husband and the wife shall be taken, the aged with him that is full of days. Now, as far as this judgment which would be coming upon Jerusalem, we realize that the fury has to be the idea of someone who has been poisoned and there's a feverish result from such a poisoning. And by the way, poisoning leads to death normally if we have enough of it. I am weary in holding in. I will pour it out. And so this idea of the fury is spilled forth so that others will be affected by it. And it's upon the children abroad. Now I want you to notice the depth and the width of those who are affected. The children refer to those who are suckling babies. They haven't been weaned from the mother. Then we come to the young men. And these would be the youthful people. I would suppose that would be anywhere from three or four up until the day of accountability, whereby they would perhaps enter into marriage or something like this. Then it talks about the husband and wife there, doesn't it? And so we have all ages right up into there, and so we have the whole family involved. And I suppose this would include those who would then re-ride up until the children leave home. And if you don't like this one, the aged, those are the people who are empty nesters and beyond. And then we have him that is full of days. And perhaps that includes the idea of the aged here, but full of days, that brings it right up to every one of us who are here. This judgment, this chastisement, is to include everybody. When we're talking about the gleaned fields, everything is taken out. When we're talking about the families involved here, families that would be related to this judgment, why that would include everybody. So we're talking about from the youngest all the way to the oldest. It sounds to me like the Lord is, when He's going to chasten this city, they are in for some very, very serious trouble. And not only that, but in verse 12 it talks about their homes shall be turned to others, their fields and wives together. So I would suggest here that when we're talking about fields, homes, fields, and wives, especially the judgment is related to the men. Men, are we responsible or not? That's the question we have to ask. When we talk to people concerning following the will of God and hearing and being fearful of the God of heaven who can either bless us or curse us, men, are we paying attention? And men, as we speak to men, are they paying attention? They need to pay attention because it's going to be a terrible thing. For I will stretch out my hand upon the inhabitants of the land, saith the Lord. And the word hand here suggests an open hand rather than a fist. I would suggest that there might be a possibility of a little bit of grace involved there. Because which would you rather be hit by? An open hand or a fist? Which would you rather be chastened with? And by the way, they usually say, and they've said this all the time I've been around, is when you chasten a child, you don't do it with a closed hand, you do it with an open hand. And there's a difference. But the chastening still can be severe and serious. And so this is something that we need to keep in mind. Verse 13, for from the least of them, even to the greatest of them, everyone is given to, we're coming up with another sin here. This is an underlying situation that's a part of the culture that's in Jerusalem. For why would you oppress a people except that covetousness is an underlying thought? And I would also suggest that this covetousness, and the idea of covetousness is not that I just, Somebody back here had a camera, flashed it when we first started. I think I want that camera. And so I'm going to plunder the one who owns it. I'm going to unjustly gain it. That's the idea of covetousness. Now think about the concept of a seriousness and intent and the process of gaining that which is someone else's. Covetousness is what's involved here. From the least of them, even to the greatest of them, of everyone, is given to covetousness. So this was the modus operandi. It means the way everybody does it in Jerusalem. And is that the way we do it as individuals here in this congregation? We better not be. But because we have to speak to the people outside the walls, who, for the most part, that's the way, that's what gets them up in the morning, that's what gets them to work, and that's what gets them back home, and that's the whole operation of their recreation time and private time and their goals right up until they die into retirement. Covetousness is a primary goal for that, and they're out plundering every way they know how to get that. And it's the plunder concept that we ought to have stripped out of us. And this is what God apparently was wanting to strip out of the city of Jerusalem and the people who were there and the Israelites and those who were there. They were out not for right reasons, doing for right cause and right purpose what they were doing. Covetousness was a chief there. Now, we could cut off the rest of the verse because the pastor doesn't want to hear it. Oh, the prophets and the priests that everyone deal with falsely? I don't want to hear it either. But notice the concept that's involved here. It's the leadership. The leadership of the soul, the leadership of the morals, the leadership of the ways. And so, folks, when we're talking and we're witnessing to people concerning their need to be obedient to the will of God, the laws of God, the ways of God, and fearing God, we need to speak to the preachers and those who are involved in the moral settings of a community just as much as anyone else. Is that not true? They're the ones who are setting the standard, or should be. They're the ones who speak to the mayors and the congressmen and the senators and whatever level they are. Are we setting the standard? Or are we involved in the plunder and teaching them the wrong ways? But see, now as we are priests and kings and such as, you know, as people, as children of God, and as we should be setting the standard ourselves as we go out, what is the method of operation that we basically operate under? We need to think about this because we're the ones who are giving the testimony. And if it isn't you and I who gives the testimony, there isn't anybody else that's going to give it because they like what they're doing. Not only that, but these priests and prophets and priests and such, verse 14, they have healed also the hurt of my daughter, of the daughter of my people. How much? Now you see, covetousness is involved there. And we're talking about the priests and the prophets, and they deal falsely. And in the process of all this, they have healed also the hurt. Yeah, people are hurt by covetousness, aren't they? And notice how they heal it. The hurt of the daughter of my people, just slightly. And the idea is really, it's triflingly. It's they lightly go into this and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You feel so bad. This is really sad that you're having these troubles. I don't know what to." And they might even shed tears. But when they trifle with truth, and they trifle with righteousness, and by the way, we have heard this even in these last few days in our country. Our country is in much sorrow. We've lost 40% or 60% of our money, and things are so tough, and jobs aren't out there. And Small business is doing just fine. Peace, peace there is when there is no peace. Claiming things are good when they're not. That's the idea that's involved here. Peace, peace when there is no peace. Of course, the idea here is that we're going back to the people from the north who've leaned out their windows and said, "Ah, I see Jerusalem, let's head that way." And they're coming and they're going to bring destruction. And the priests of Jerusalem, who were involved in the covetousness, which is the reason God is causing these people to sit out their windows and look towards Jerusalem and mount up their packs and get things put together and to march that way, for the very reason of these same people, what they're doing, and these people are saying, "Don't worry, things are okay, God will take care of it, it's just fine, everything is okay, things are good." Were they ashamed? Verse 15. When they committed abomination? Nay, they were not at all ashamed, neither could they blush. Therefore, they shall fall among them that fall. At the time that I visit them, they shall be cast down, saith the Lord. Be careful if you give false comfort. Be careful if you're involved in things that are displeasing, sins that God does not like. Fountains casting out water, so she casteth out her wickedness. Be careful what you think and what you do, because the people from the north, or somebody, God's going to use somebody to deal with us in some way, in some manner. And we need to warn the people of this country, just because we live across the ocean from everybody else. Doesn't mean they can't come from the south, it doesn't mean they can't come from the north, and it doesn't mean that they just can't come any old way they happen to figure out how to decide to come and take care of us if we're going to follow in these paths as a nation or as individuals. Why can't God raise up somebody across town to deal with us and to chasten us? He doesn't have to use a nation. He can use an individual or a small group. How is it that we're going to be considering ourselves as we go about our lives? Dear Heavenly Father, thank you that we might learn from this and we might also be able to use these kinds of messages as examples from history in warning other people. Oh, Father, there is that real probability that they have uncircumcised ears, not given over, where they will not hearken, they refuse. Yet we are still responsible to speak and to warn, to call the trumpet sound, to build the fires of warning. Father, may we be careful and faithful. I thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.